let's wait till the court clears out. Let's wait till the court clears out. All right. Good morning. Mr. Lenz, we would like both parties to address the order we issued about the effect of Noel Canning on this case.
Very good, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Thomas Lenz, counsel for Hyundai America Shipping Agency. Would the court prefer that I address Noel Canning first?
Yes.
The ruling by this circuit in Noel Canning is a new development in the context of the case I am handling, involving the National Labor Relations Board and Hyundai. And the ruling, of course, goes to the issue of whether the board had a valid quorum and looked to the recess appointment clause as to the most recent recess appointees, Block and Griffith, and or Block and Griffin, excuse me. And the case before us in Hyundai involves recess appointee Craig Becker. And Mr. Becker was appointed in March of 2010, which, according to the ruling in Noel Canning, is something of concern because it was not made during the recess between Senate sessions. And it was not a vacancy which arose during the recess between Senate sessions. The Noel Canning ruling does not place a time limitation on when the argument is made. It is a new development, and therefore it is certainly, in our view, appropriately raised at this stage in the Hyundai case.
In the Ryder case, which I think is the last Supreme Court discussion of the de facto officer doctrine, the court draws a distinction between the person or party who first raises a challenge to the status of a purported officer and others, and doesn't say that person is always going to get relief, but at least it indicates that one important factor is keeping an incentive for bringing such challenge. So that would be true of Noel Canning, but not so true of your client.
That's correct. We certainly recognize we're not the first to raise this issue, but we are here at a time where this ruling is brand new. And given the manner in which it was written, this opinion, we feel, does apply to our case as well. And I would suspect that the court will determine the scope of this ruling, and I fully expect that the board will want to fight this to the highest level. I have nothing further to offer on Noel Canning unless you have questions.
Why don't you go to the merits? Go to the merits,
okay.
Yeah.
This is a case in which the board has acted outside of its typical scope and in a view that, in our view, is flawed and unenforceable. This was a single employee termination charge. That is all that appears on the face of the unfair labor practice charge filed by an individual. It's a protected concerted activity case, no union issues involved. And the issues that are on appeal are not the termination. That was litigated before an ALJ, and the board upheld that termination as lawful. What we are dealing with is issues of a confidentiality instruction, which was orally given in the context of a sexual harassment investigation, and it involves certain handbook policies, none of which were raised in investigation of the charge, and certainly not contained within the text of the charge.
But some of them, I thought that she was fired because of violation of some of them. My notes said the email rule, the working hours rule, as well as the oral instruction that you identified. She was fired in part because of that, right? Wasn't that tied up with her?
Well, it's not necessarily a violation of the written policies that were in the handbook. There were five grounds stated at the time of Ms. McCulloch's termination. And those grounds were dishonesty as it related to demurrage. This is a shipping company which is heavily regulated. And
where are you in the joint appendix now? Because I have to say one of the things that was most baffling about this case was what documentation there was in terms of what the original episode was that led to this proliferation of claims against the rules. So there's material at page 89 of the joint appendix. And what else are you pointing to in terms of...
The grounds for termination?
Yes.
Well, I think the most readily accessible list would be in the decision that the board made, and I can refer you to that.
Well, I'm sorry, does the decision have direct quotes from what Hyundai did?
The decision has direct quotes of the reasons for the termination.
And those are straight from Hyundai?
From Hyundai.
Okay, sorry.
When you say straight from Hyundai, it's straight from the termination document, if that's...
Okay, so what page is that? There's some material quoted by the... board brief at page 6.
Yes, and...
That quotes besides page 89, I guess, at 125, 126 of the joint appendix.
I am looking at the deferred appendix, which contains the board decision with the ALJ decision, and I think the most thorough listing is at page 127 of 141, looking at the top. There is a listing which refers to dishonesty.
127?
127 and 141.
Okay.
If you look at the second column, reason number one is dishonesty regarding issuance of a personal check for an import shipment. That's the demurrage issue. The second reason, blind carbon copying third parties on confidential issues. This arose in a sexual harassment context where confidentiality is required by EEOC standards and California law standards, which Hyundai has followed in all of its facilities, including this in Arizona. The third reason is email sent by Ms. McCullough.
But isn't the key inquiry here what she alleged in the complaint? You're now telling us what was actually proved, but I thought the inquiry... And what you're getting at is, I take it, whether the board was justified in going through the rules to see if there was anything amiss there. And my understanding was that inquiry turns on the nature of the complaint. And in the complaint, Ms. McCullough alleged that she was terminated for violation of these rules, right?
She was terminated for five different types of misconduct, not necessarily linked to handbook rules.
But in her complaint, she alleged that she was terminated for violation of the rules.
The complaint is by the general counsel.
The complaint is by the general counsel. The charge she filed is...
valid only insofar as it's related to the charge.
Correct. If you look at page 61 of the appendix, the complaint in the allegation says, since on or about August 5, 2009, the above-named employer has interfered with, restrained, and coerced its employees in the exercise of their Section 7 rights by its actions, including terminating Sandra McCulloch because she engaged in protected concerted activities. Nothing further. Nothing which embraces handbook policies. Nothing which goes to the reasons for which she was terminated or gives the general counsel cause to include those in a complaint. This court in Lotus Suites and Precision Concrete spoke to the board's lack of authority to prosecute issues which are not raised in a complaint.
In the charge,
that's correct. And that's exactly what the board did in spite of the instructions this court gave in Lotus Suites and in Precision Concrete. And this is a situation where because of the nature of the allegations, Ms. McCulloch was quite busy, quite active in interacting with other employees. That's certainly acknowledged in the record. But this employer has a right to maintain civility and decency. The AdTrans case...
You're getting on to the merits, but I think the gap between the complaint and the charge seems unanswered.
Yeah, it's something that we asked the regional office to explain when they announced they would prosecute, because this was not investigated, and we made a motion to strike because it's simply not something we were put on notice of before it went into litigation.
And that motion did not produce an analysis of the issue.
It led to a conclusive reasoning from the ALJ and the board that they were somehow related, but that's very self-serving in our view. Looks like my time is up. Or
do you have any questions, Judge Griffin? All right, we'll give you a couple minutes.
So,
I mean, we'll give you a couple minutes in reply.
To rebut. Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. Ms. Beard, if you would address the Noel Canning effect. You had filed a motion for supplemental briefing, which Hyundai has opposed, and those will be resolved at a later date. So if you would just address the Noel Canning issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Heather Beard for the National Labor Relations Board, and we're asking for enforcement. And preliminarily, as we did explain in our motion for supplemental briefing that we filed last week, there are several potential implications of Noel Canning for this case. And the board and the Department of Justice need that time to work through those legal issues. Hyundai did not raise a recess appointments challenge in this case, and thus that question and related issues have not been briefed here. And we submit that, as the order of another panel of this court in Alden Leeds indicates, there are several potentially relevant legal questions in light of Noel Canning, and they were not previously raised in these cases, and the government needs time to provide its considered views on the topics. Indeed, yesterday in the Alden Leeds case, an order was issued granting the board's motion for an extension of time of 30 days until March 1st to address these issues fully. And that is what, at this time, I'm prepared to discuss with regard to the impact of Noel Canning on this case. The questions will be answered, and we stand ready to do that. Right. And if I may now turn to the merits. Okay. Let me start with the closely related allegation of the charge and the complaint. The test that has been upheld for determining whether or not a complaint is sufficiently closely related enough to a charge when the complaint contains allegations not in the charge is the closely related test. And that test has been the Red Eye case in the board, which has been upheld by this circuit in the drug plastics case. And in that case, there is a three-part test to determine whether or not, even if a claim is not made in a charge, if the complaint is closely related sufficiently. And there is substantial evidence on this record that the complaint was closely related to the charge to meet that test.
I'm sorry, that's just an assertion, right? It's not an analysis.
The analysis is in the ALJ's decision. I believe it is in one of the footnotes that the administrative law judge says at the very beginning of the ALJ's opinion, which the board summarily adopted. And in that
directly to the footnote.
I'm sorry, say that again, Your Honor.
What footnote?
I am searching for it right now. That footnote is in the decision in order, page 6, footnote number 4. Footnote number 4, the administrative law judge describes, as we do in our brief, that there was a motion to strike the complaint allegations, and then the judge decides that...
Just an assertion. I don't see any analysis at all.
Okay, Your Honor, I would point you respectfully to the phrase, the sentence that begins, "These collective matters are both factually and legally closely related, as it is alleged by the general counsel that the respondent was discharged not only because she engaged in protected concerted activity, she was in violation of certain of the respondent's employee handbook language and its employment practices. Such handbook language and employment practices are also alleged by the general counsel to be unlawful. All these allegations certainly relate back to the timely filed charge in this case, and thus timeliness is not an issue."
That seems to be just a statement of the conclusion. And timeliness is not the only problem with the relationship between the charge and the complaint.
Well, the analysis...
The general counsel doesn't have power to bring a complaint independent of the charge.
That's
a question of authority that's involved here.
That's correct. The administrative law judge, in citing those cases and describing the two key things about this case that make them...
That does not qualify as reasoned decision-making in this court.
We would submit, Your Honor, that the mere fact that the company initiated the work rules as the big issue in this case, when that was the reason...
That's what's conspicuously missing. Evidence that the company asserted these rules as the basis of the dismissal.
Yes.
You have a recitation in your brief at page 6, and it weaves in some rules, to be sure, but one of them, the harmless gossip, is one where the board upheld the rule. The sexual harassment by her doesn't seem to be any basis for anything the board has done. Dishonesty, you're not objecting to any rules against dishonesty, as I understand it. So all that's left is blind carbon copying third parties, which incidentally is this quote from material from Hyundai doesn't invoke any particular rule.
I think one of the things that might be a problem here, Your Honor, and I apologize for this, when you were looking through the joint appendix and you pointed my opposing counsel to page 89, which is the document, the memorandum as to the
part
of it, that's correct. Okay. Missing from the appendix,
right,
for some reason, is the remainder of that document.
I'm not sure that...
That's where the work...
of any analysis by the board, I'm not sure that even if we had the document, it would do any good.
We do have the document in the record, Your Honor, and we're very happy to provide that, because throughout that document, it does talk about violation of the company's handbook and its work rules. And the company just...
That's not searchable, right? It's not searchable from outside.
I'm sorry,
It's in the record, but it's not obtainable over the web, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. We do have the record that I believe in the D.C. Circuit. We submit the record of the hearing and the proceedings to the court, and we can get it for you very quickly, because what that will show is that there was, throughout the course of that termination memorandum, there were reasons listed citing the employee handbook and conduct. And while they were not exactly matched up to the specific reasons that the company put on that first page of the document, the thread of why Ms. McCullough was disciplined.
I don't see how we could possibly review this without seeing that document. And second, depending upon what the document said, it seems most improbable, in light of the fact that you rest entirely on footnote 4, seems most unlikely that we could find reasoned decision-making there, unless for some reason or other this document makes it obvious that you're right.
Sure. Well, I would submit, with regard to the document, we're going to provide that the work rules are, the handbook and conduct rules are stated, that the phrase handbook and conduct rules is stated throughout that document. The second thing I would say, it isn't just footnote.
What you're saying, that there are allusions to handbook and rules, but nothing pins it down to the particular rules that the general counsel decided to challenge.
Well, required for the closely related test is not every single work rule mentioned. What we submitted in our brief is that the work rules and handbook, as reasons given for her termination, many of them were ones for which she was terminated, that those were... Sure. If we go through the ones that we have in our brief that are in that memorandum, and I believe they're also on the first page that's available in the joint appendix, blind copying emails from an EEO investigation is one of the rules of conduct that they allege that she violated.
My understanding is that there's no rule, at least none of the rules that the board struck down was a rule worded as a rule against blind copying.
Specifically, you're right, Your Honor, it wasn't against blind copying, but it was against sharing or disclosing information about EEO investigations.
That seems to be your strongest rule, your strongest connection.
There was that, and there was also the oral rule that Human Resource Manager Brandy Andrews testified she regularly gave to employees and instructed them to give. There's also specifically the complaining to an employee instead of going directly to management rule. That was a rule that the board found was unlawful.
Is there any place in either the ALJ decision or the board decision that wrestles with the question of the relationship between this and EEOC rules?
Yes, in the board's decision and order, the board talks extensively about two cases that involve confidentiality during investigations, the Caesars Palace case and the additional case, and I will get you that page, the Phoenix Transit Systems case. It's on page 15 of the decision and order. And the board specifically talks about the employer's legitimate... I'm sorry?
This is
in the administrative law judge decision that was adopted by the board. That's correct. And it's on page 15 where the discussion is about the employer's substantial and legitimate business justification of confidentiality.
I don't see any discussion there of the EEOC rules. Now, it may be that board rules trump EEOC rules, but there's no discussion of that.
Well, I suppose maybe I'm speaking, I'm misspeaking, Your Honor. I'm meaning when you say EEO, I'm thinking about a sexual harassment type of case, which is...
EEOC is deeply involved in that, right?
Right, which is what the board is talking about on page 15. There's certainly reference...
talking about what the EEOC requires.
Right, what the board is doing is balancing, as it says throughout on page 15, the rights of employees to engage in their Section 7 activities and the legitimate employer interest in confidentiality.
Another agency in the United States with authority over the same issue has made the balance differently.
That's actually, Your Honor, we're not saying that we should or do trump EEOC regulations. None of the EEO regulations.
Then I think you'd have to talk about the EEOC regulations.
And we did in our brief. What we pointed out is that...
We review the decision, not your brief.
It's also in the decision, respectfully, Your Honor, on page 15.
Well, we were just there, and
right. If you look,
certainly didn't seem to talk about it.
Okay. Well, if we're on page 15, I can point you to what the administrative law judge says at the top of the second column, and what he says is, he's of the view in the matter at hand, the respondent has failed to meet its burden, that there's a legitimate and substantial justification for the rule, and because it's undisputed that the managers and human resource supervisors routinely instruct employees not to talk about it with other employees on the substance, and that the admonitions are given in every case without individual review, that under the board's balancing test, the respondent has the responsibility to first...
That's the board's balancing test, which doesn't include any consideration whatever of the EEOC.
Right. The board in the Phoenix Trans...
No point in reading more of that to me unless you are actually going to point to something alluding to the EEOC rules.
Well, I would point you to page 15, obviously. And
I have it in front of me. I'm fascinated by it.
And I would say that the board in later cases has also discussed this very issue, and the board's position is that, of course, the concerns... They must balance the concerns of employees' rights and the employer's interest in keeping investigations confidential, but that does not mean that the EEO rules require that there is blanket confidentiality. And this court has agreed with the fact that if there is a way a rule can be written in the Cintas case from 2007, if there is a way a rule can be written that more narrowly can address the employer's confidentiality concerns, that that is the way that the rule should be written. And so with regard to that particular confidentiality rule, what the board did is a reasonable balance of those factors of employee rights as well as the employer, and found the employer wanting with individualized particularity. And that's what the board reasonably found here. And we would submit that under the cases, under the Red Eye case, as well as under the Carney case that the board decided in our brief on the closely related matter, that the board has taken into concern this circuit's specific admonition about closely related allegations in the complaint and the charge, and that that is what we have in this case. So I see I'm well over my time, but I'm happy to continue if you have any other questions about that issue.
Mr. Lentz, okay, why don't you take a couple minutes? Do you want that document?
What?
Do you want that document?
Yes.
All right. Ms. Beard, if you would provide the rest of the document on page 89 for however far it goes, okay.
There's definitely a disconnect between the board's position on the policies and the termination, as has just been discussed. This is not a case like Cintas or Guardsmark, which this case is, or which this circuit has decided and which the board refers to in argument in brief. Those are cases where policies at issue more clearly tried to regulate what employees said about their own working conditions. And that's clearly Section 7 activity that is being chilled. That's not what's happening here. This is about maintaining limited regulation of what happens with information in the context of a sexual harassment investigation, in the context of reasonable work rules designed to provide decency in the workplace. The general counsel, in attempting to prosecute handbook policies, went beyond information they had on the discharge to shoot and see what they could get. And they have several policies now before this court, which are reasonable regulations. And the argument we've heard indicates that the board is purely speculating as to a tie between those policies and this discharge. But the lack of attention to the EEOC's role, to the importance of regulating sexual harassment and maintaining decency, really shows, I think more than anything, a contempt for employers' rights and needs to set standards in the workplace. And that's all we're trying to do. And for that reason, the board's ruling should be denied enforcement. Our petition for review should be granted.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.